Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the University of Central Florida, offering their Master's of Science in Data Analytics program. Designed to enhance skills in data analysis and machine learning, the new Artificial Intelligence track offers specialized courses to deepen understanding of AI technologies and their applications. More at ce.ucf.edu/data.
I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Hi, folks. I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer. This is Growing Boulder, produced by the Boulder Media Group. My apologies for my asthma-induced laryngitis, but the show must go on, and we've got a great one for you today. In just a moment, you'll meet the network television correspondent who had an embarrassing implosion on the air that might have cost him his job, but instead, it actually led to a life-changing discovery.
You know, you don't sound that bad. I like that, Mark. It's kind of gravelly, and you know.
I appreciate that.
Plus, one of America's top travel experts tells us how to be the world's smartest traveler.
We also have one of the most inspirational people you will ever meet. He's a Navy veteran who is now a quadriplegic multi-sport superstar. All of that and more coming up in this edition of Growing Boulder.
He's a former network war correspondent and a news anchor on ABC who co-hosts Nightline and is a correspondent for the weekend edition of Good Morning America. And he got a good bit of unwelcome publicity. This was back in 2004 when on the air he had a full-blown panic attack with over 5 million viewers watching.
Yeah,
can you imagine?
I remember that well. And as often the case, the bad times lead to the good, and that's what happened in this case, folks. He discovered that he had some real issues and found a surprising way of dealing with them. It's all laid out in a wickedly funny book that may be the most unusual book ever written on the subject of meditation. It's called 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. A true story. Let's find out more as we chat with ABC news anchor and author Dan Harris. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for the kind welcome.
Well, you know, thanks for writing the book because it is fascinating. And what happened after your panic attack is incredible. But let's talk about the underlying issues that brought it on because you spent 6 years in Mideast war zones. When you returned, you say that you self-medicated with what most people would consider recreational drugs.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I think it was all kind of a series of mindless decisions, really. I got to ABC News when I was a kid, really. I was 28, and I looked barely post-pubescent, and I was working with these giants like Peter Jennings and Diane Sawyer, and my way of coping with that, was my insecurity about that, was to become a workaholic. And then 9/11 came along, and I volunteered to go to these war zones without ever really thinking about the psychological consequences. And when I got home after a particularly long stretch, I got depressed. And I wasn't even self-aware enough to know that I was depressed. I just wasn't feeling good. And before I got diagnosed with depression officially, I just blindly self-medicated with cocaine and ecstasy. And even though I was only doing it for a brief period of time and wasn't doing it when I was on the air or when I was working, it blew up in my face. And with that panic attack, which, you know, I found out later that the drugs raised the level of adrenaline in your brain and primed me to have that panic attack. And when I realized what a moron I'd been, I knew I needed to, you know, make some changes.
And you know what, Dan? One of the most interesting parts of your story is that we can, you know, you tell it so well, but there's no way that you're the only guy going through something like, look what you had here. Stressful career, too many drugs, depression, and an out-of-control inner voice, which really combined to this, you know, we all have this. So you called these inner voice a major pain in the you-know-what. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I talk a lot about the inner voice in the book, and I want to be clear from the jump that I'm not talking about schizophrenia here. I'm talking about the inner narrator that is the central feature of all of our lives, whether we're aware of it or not. And when we're not aware of it, it yanks us around. And that the primary characteristics of this voice are that it's repetitive, it's negative, it's often negative. It's ceaselessly self-referential. It's constantly casting forward into the future, thinking about the past instead of just focusing on what's happening right now. It has us judging other people, wanting things, not wanting things, et cetera, et cetera. That's the nature of the voice. And when it was pointed out to me that that is basically our lives, but there's a way to tame it, I got very interested.
Folks, we're talking with Dan Harris, ABC News anchor and correspondent, and let's talk about taming it, because you were really not the kind of guy predisposed to get into meditation. You thought, as many do, that it was really kind of a hippie swami thing, but tell us how Peter Jennings actually pushed you in that direction unknowingly.
Yeah, unwittingly, very much. He was a guy who could have used a little bit of meditation, but he assigned me to cover faith and spirituality for ABC News, and this kicked into high gear right around the time that I was realizing that I'd been a moron in my private life. So the confluence of these two events shoved me in the direction of finding meditation. It took many years before I got there, and I want to be clear that I didn't use meditation to fix my drug problem. I went to see a medical professional for that. But I had always assumed it was only for weirdos, that it was for, you know, people who lived in a yurt or collected crystals and were really into Cat Stevens, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't something that I had any interest in doing. But then I heard about the science, and the science is extremely compelling. It shows that that meditation can lower your blood pressure, boost your immune system, and literally rewire key parts of your brain that have to do with well-being and stress. And that really got me intrigued.
It's a weird thing, though, to try for the first few times, isn't it? Most people, when they meditate, it's frustrating. Nothing seems to happen. It's hard. It's underwhelming. How did you take to it initially?
All of those things are absolutely true, and I think it's based on misapprehensions of what meditation actually is. People think that the goal is to, quote-unquote, clear the mind, which is impossible until you die, perhaps. You're not going to clear the mind. What meditation is exercise for your brain, and you are trying to, it's essentially a focusing exercise. So you're trying to focus on one thing at a time, which is a radical act in this age of information overload. And in this case, usually what you're focusing on is your breath. You're not breathing in a special way. You're just trying to focus on the feeling of the breath coming in and going out. And then every time your mind wanders, which it will a million times, to all sorts of crazy inane things like what are you going to have for lunch, et cetera, you just catch your mind wandering and bring your attention back to your breath. It sounds ridiculously simple, and on some levels it is, but it is also a bicep curl for your brain, because you're breaking a lifetime of habit of walking around in this daydream about the future and the past, and instead focusing on what's happening right now. I just would hasten to add that in the 1940s, if you told somebody you were going running, they would say, "Who's chasing you?" Public health revolutions happen fast. Nobody exercised in this country in any systematic way in the middle of the last century. Now, many of us do, and if we don't, we feel guilty about it. The same thing is happening now with meditation, because what happened with exercise is science proved it's really good for you, and that's starting to happen with meditation. So I think the PR problem that meditation has, and has many, is being chipped away at, and I think we're going to see more people starting to do this, and it will help to have more quote-unquote normal people, or those who aren't wearing robes or long dangly earrings and shawls out there talking about this.
You know, Dan, I think you've taken a big step toward, chipping away at this misconception when you describe it as exercise for the brain, which I have never heard. And, of course, everybody of a certain age now is just living in fear of dementia and Alzheimer's. People fear that more than they do cancer these days. Other than shutting your brain down to some extent, is there science that says that this exercise may actually delay the onset of dementia?
There is science that I'm aware of that shows that it slows age-related cognitive decline. So I haven't looked deeply into those studies, but they're there and very, very interesting and intriguing to me for sure. I find it comforting, for example, that my mom is now doing it. And my mom is a scientist and a very skeptical human being, and she read the studies and realized that this was something that probably could help her. I think just as we take care of our bodies because we want to be as healthy as possible for as long as possible, we need to start thinking about taking care of our minds and our brains.
Your job, Dan, is a very high-pressure job. Everybody knows that. But these days, every career is very high-pressured, so there have to be a lot of people going through what you did. Have you heard from any other big names in the news business that have confided in you, that they've shared similar feelings?
Oh, I think the experience of being in a high-pressure job and letting the stress drag you down is extremely common. And yes, I've heard from a lot of people in the news business about the accuracy of the portrayal of the stresses. But, you know, I would, you know, hasten to add that whatever you're doing in your life, if you're trying to be great at it, it is stressful. And that could be true of being a volunteer in your retirement. It could be true of being a parent or a grandparent. It could be true of whatever career you have, even if it's not as high profile or stressful as the one I happen to occupy right now. And there is stress and strain inherent in this kind of pursuit, the pursuit of excellence of any quality. And I think we need that. Some of that stress and strain is really useful. I'm not arguing that we should, you know, become zenned out zombies. However, what I've noticed is that we tend to make our suffering worse than it needs to be. And that is where the value add for me of meditation is. By the 17th time that I'm worrying about whether I'm going to make my flight and all the awful consequences of for whatever story I'm working on, if I miss that flight might be, I've learned to ask myself, is this useful? Should I maybe start thinking about something else at this point? Because the 18th time I run through these consequences is no longer going to be helpful.
Folks, you know, in this celebrity-obsessed culture that we live in, Bill and I have often said that the highest use, the highest value of a celebrity anywhere is to share their problems with the rest of us and what they've learned so that we know we're not alone and that we can learn from their experiences. And folks, Dan Harris, ABC News anchor, has done exactly that. His book is called 10% Higher, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. It's not only a true story. It's a lot of fun to read. This is a guy with a great sense of humor and an ability to string words together. Dan, thanks so much for your time, and good luck with the book.
Coming up, The Art of Life, how an abstract painter finds purpose in her paintings. This is Growing Bolder.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Bolder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Bolder. You know, we all capture and save the experiences that we have in our lives in different ways. Artist Martha Jo Mahoney, she takes pictures with her mind, and she has this gift to translate them into abstract paintings. Now in her 60s, Mahoney's doing the best work she's ever done, and she enjoys the process more than ever. In fact, she uses her art not just to communicate with the world, but sometimes to escape it.
Inside her studio, with a brush in her hand, artist Martha Jo Mahoney is communicating with the outside world.
I really paint because it's my soul. I have to paint. It's my language. It's what I have to say to you. And this is how I say it.
Martha is an avid traveler whose only camera is her mind. Her art is a feeling derived from nature, an abstract impression of her memories translated onto canvas or paper.
This is called snorkeling, so I like to snorkel, obviously.
Like most accomplished abstract painters, Martha has the technical expertise to paint realistic landscapes or portraits, but it's the challenge of abstraction that draws her into the studio every day.
In about 1995, I started abstracting, and once I abstracted, I never went back, never looked back. I found what I really love to do. It's problem solving. Continually you're problem solving. So you're constantly taking away or adding to, taking away and adding to. What don't you need? How can you say it the least way? Hmm. Especially with abstraction.
Martha's work wins major awards, has been shown nationwide, and is collected worldwide. But her biggest commission, at least in terms of size, is the 45-foot-high mural on the side of a building in downtown Orlando. The critics loved it, but she knew it was a big deal because...
My aunt even came down from Kalamazoo, Michigan to see it. It was neat.
While painting is how Martha communicates with the world, it's also how she escapes it.
When I paint, I forget about anything else that might be really bugging me. Children, grandchildren, spouses, financial problems, anything I'm upset about, I can take it out right here on the canvas and scare the hell out of me, you know? But I get it out here. And sometimes it's the best work I've done.
Now in her mid-60s, Martha is creating her best work ever.
Age it's a state of mind.
That state of mind was severely tested just over 1 year ago when she was diagnosed with aortic valve stenosis, a disease of the heart valves that can lead to sudden death. She was in such bad shape that doctors recommended a risky open-heart surgery to transplant a life-saving bovine valve. As the surgery approached, Martha spent more time with her family and friends and more time in the studio painting her impressions of what lie ahead.
This one was done right before surgery.
Oh, wow.
And it's called The Gathering, and it's kind of like we're all gathering together to see if she makes it. Will she make it? So this is my spirit, and this is my strength, and I'm gathering myself for this wonderful... operation I'm going to get through.
The operation was a success, but recovery hasn't been easy. She says without her husband, family, friends, and painting, she might not have made it.
I just need this. That's really, and a brush in my hand. And I feel so good after that. I've had that, and that's enough for me.
While the process of painting is nearly sacred to Martha, her paintings are not.
My thought is you've got these big canvases. If they don't sell after a while, get rid of them. They're not, so precious to me. Just paint over them.
This canvas used to be a human figure, a nude, before she painted over it.
I said, boy, I'm tired of you. Maybe you're not the best nude I've ever made, so you're out of here. And I like that much better.
Ultimately, a great abstract painting is a lot like a great life.
If it's got the right balance, if it's got the right movement, if it's going to hold together.
And Martha Jo Mahoney fully understands the goal for both is to reach the point that you say,
I don't think I could put one more stroke on there that would add to that thing. I just like it the way it is.
And we are happy to report that Martha's health and her art are both better than ever. And you know, Bill, as collectible as her art is, she doesn't take it or herself too seriously. In fact, she's not afraid to paint over a canvas and start all over again, which I think is really a great metaphor, folks, for life in general. We can't be afraid to try something new, to start over, take away something and add something else. And then, like Martha does in her painting, just continue to refine until we've actually created the life that we want.
It's so cool. Because even if we don't feel like we have artistic talent, we all have a talent for expression. And just throwing color up and getting all these things out can be a huge help taking our mind off of the daily issues that we have. Something that provides us the kind of escape that Martha gets from her painting. Coming up, a legendary athlete who proves that you can overcome no matter what life throws at you. How? Well, that's next on Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts.
I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is the Growing Boulder program. Time now for our surviving and thriving interview. With the right kind of care and support, and most importantly, the right attitude, it is possible to not only survive life's greatest challenges, but to actually thrive in the aftermath.
Here's a statistic that hopefully you'll pay attention to. 1 in 5 of us have a disability, 1 in 5 Americans, and we all have a 20% chance of becoming disabled at some point. Our next guest, in fact, is a 46-year-old Navy veteran, multi-sport athlete who competed in triathlons and marathons. He's a sports journalist, an entrepreneur, a motivational speaker, a father and a husband, and he is also a quadriplegic, a 5-time quad division champion of the Boston Marathon. And in 22 years of competition, he has won 79 gold medals in the National Wheelchair Veterans Games. Let's welcome the legendary Mike Savicki. How are you, Mike?
Fine, thanks. Legendary is a bit of a stretch, but I appreciate the wonderful introduction.
I don't think anybody will argue after hearing that. You know, how did you become disabled, Mike? And where did the inspiration come from for you to do what you did?
I was a Navy pilot stationed in Pensacola, Florida, right after I graduated from college back in 1990, and was injured in a diving accident. It was kind of a fluky thing. I literally just walked up to my waist in the ocean and went to dive under a wave. The wave broke and pushed my head down. I hit the sand on the bottom and had a compression fracture, basically. The force of my body was too much for my neck, and a bone chip. The C6 and the C7 vertebrae hit the spinal cord just enough to paralyze me. It was a fluke. It changed my life in an instant. And from there, I had to relearn how to do pretty much everything in my life all over again. And finding inspiration was something that didn't come easy. I had to dig down, kind of look inside me, and realized that I was still the same person I was before I was injured. I just had to learn to do things differently. And for me, sports has always been a part of my life. So getting back into sports was as important to my rehabilitation as it was to getting on living.
So you went from a guy, Mike, who had to relearn everything, to a guy who is now teaching us all, you know, some very important lessons about life in general. You're now one of over 18 million people in the U.S. and Canada that have mobility issues, and you've been named the spokesperson for National Mobility Awareness Month for the third year in a row. What is that, and what's the goal?
Well, May is National Mobility Awareness Month. It's the annual celebration that encourages seniors, veterans, caregivers, and people with disabilities to enjoy active, mobile lifestyles, basically to get out there and make the most of what you still have. It's organized by a group called the National Mobility Equipment Dealers Association. They're a group of approximately 600 mobility dealers, manufacturers, and driving rehabilitation specialists that are in place just to help people with disabilities get back out there. You brought up a really interesting number. You said 18 million people in the U.S. and Canada have mobility issues, and 6 million of those, believe it or not, are veterans, people like myself who've sustained injuries, whether it's in the line of duty or not, and also veterans and seniors who are aging into their disabilities. So it's a number that we don't know much about. May is in place to really promote the opportunities that people have, and National Mobility Awareness Month is a fantastic campaign. I'm proud to be a part of it.
I was reading something, too, about the Local Heroes campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how we could maybe nominate somebody that we know?
Yeah, the Local Heroes campaign is really at the heart and soul of Mobility Awareness Month. What we're looking for are people from communities across the country. people with disabilities, caregivers, seniors, veterans, you know, the group I mentioned earlier, we're actually giving away four fully accessible, customized vehicles to local heroes, people who are inspirational, people who are overcoming mobility challenges in the communities across the country. Now, these vehicles, believe it or not, they're your minivans, they're your accessible vehicles, and they cost upwards of $65,000 to $70,000 each. So this is a really fantastic opportunity. And to nominate someone, we're asking you to go to mobilityawarenessmonth.com, upload a story, whether it's just a couple hundred words and a photo or a short two-minute video, get the person into our competition, our contest, and then collect votes. And from there, the top 10% of vote getters will become finalists. And I'm excited to see who the four winners will be this year. Having a vehicle, you know, delivered to your driveway, it can change a life.
Folks, we're talking with Mike Savicki, who is a very inspirational guy, a quadriplegic who, as we mentioned previously, a five-time quad division champion of the Boston Marathon. Mike, is it true that you actually ran the Boston Marathon before your accident, and you are the only person to finish it as both an able-bodied runner and someone that's disabled?
Yeah, believe it or not, when I was in college, I went to school in Boston. There was a short list of things I wanted to do before I graduated and left the city, and running the Boston Marathon was kind of a rite of passage. I actually ran it twice before I was injured, 1989 and 1990. And then in the fall of 1990 was when I had my spinal cord injury and had to relearn how to do everything again, and including the sports and getting back into running and racing. Long story short, I've now done it 16 times in a wheelchair. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal event, and you know, it changed my life, and it's something I hold close to my heart. I want to go back and do it a couple more times. I'm a new father now, and I think when our daughter gets old enough, I'd love for her to see her dad cross the finish line at least once more.
Mike, I can't help but think back to the Christopher Reeve thing and the discussion that entailed. And I remember a lot of people saying, well, if something like that ever happened to me, I wouldn't want to be around anymore. Here you are, the polar opposite example of that. Can you explain, going through something like that, that how that was such a bad attitude to say, well, that would be it for me?
Yeah, you never know really what you have inside you until you're put in a position where you're challenged, whether it's physically or mentally or emotionally. In my case, I was challenged physically. That was sort of on the surface by breaking my neck, but also emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, it really tested me. And what I've really had to learn was and this is a lesson for people that I've really taken to heart, is until you're put in a position, you don't know what you can do. But having an attitude to stay open to challenge, saying, you know, I can do this, I can get through something. I may not know how to do it, but I have the willingness to do it. It starts sort of one step at a time. And you can't really see the light at the end of the tunnel until you make forward motion. So for me, it was learning to push my wheelchair out of my room and into the hallway, and then out of the hospital, and then down the road, and 1 mile, and 2 miles, and 3 miles, and learning how to drive again. So, you know, how was I able to get through it? It was a long, difficult process, but it was one that came with a little bit of drive and determination, something I never knew I had inside me.
Folks, he is the inspirational Mike Savicki. You can learn more at MikeSavicki.com. And if you'd like to nominate a local hero for a new wheelchair-accessible van, go to MobilityAwarenessMonth.com. Thanks, Mike. Coming up next, the Academy Award-winning and Tony-nominated actress who at 86 is doing her best work ever. Next on Growing Bolder.
sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats too noble to neglect.
Oh my gosh. You're going to love this. Mark, you ready for this?
I am ready, yes.
Because, folks, we have for you a segment that is going to light fire to your radio. Bill Schaefer here with Mark Middleton on Growing Boulder. Our next guest is most widely known for her Academy Award-winning performance in Bonnie and Clyde and her 10 years as Mother Bev on the hit sitcom Roseanne. Do you think they know who I'm talking about yet?
I think they should, but too. If they don't, they're going to very quickly. At 86 years old, she has been doing or maybe was doing some of her best work in the Broadway play The Velocity of Autumn, for which she was nominated for a Tony Award. Welcome the amazing Estelle Parsons. Good morning, Estelle. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. But, you know, this is terrible because all of a sudden everybody starts every introduction of me with how old I am, which everybody knows you're not supposed to do that with women. You're supposed to say a certain age or something. But my whole life seems to revolve around she's 86 and she's still walking around.
Hey, Estelle.
And it's true. It's true.
This is not just any interview, though. You're on Growing Boulder, the show that turns aging upside down thanks to the amazing exploits of people like you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think she bought that, Bill. All right, let's move on because...
No, I buy it. I buy it.
All right, let's start that over. She is a veteran of the stage and the screen, Estelle Parsons.
I have been on Broadway for 58 years, and I've done 30 Broadway shows.
Unbelievable.
How many shows I've done in my whole life all around the world, that's another story, and nobody's counted them up. So.
Well, we're not going to do that today, but I do want to talk briefly about your most recent role. Talk about a roller coaster ride. You're nominated for a Tony for your performance in The Velocity of Autumn. Literally, several hours later, the announcement comes that the play is closing.
Yeah.
How do you process all of that in such a short period of time?
Yeah, it's showbiz, honey. That's how you process everything that happens in this crazy business, show business.
Well, let's talk a little about the business of life. 86 blows our minds. We love that. We have people on this program, Estelle, like you, who are accomplishing great things at this age. And all people that are listening, they're 20, they're 30, they're 40, they're going, how can I end up being like her?
Yeah. It's pure chance, you know. You wake up every morning, you do your thing, and the next thing you know, you're 86. I can't believe it. I don't know how other people are about these things, but I never thought about my age all the way along. Like, I had a playwright friend. He was, like, so depressed at 30. Then I had another one at 40. I never got depressed about my age, never even thought about it until I got to be 80. And then I thought, oh, my, I'm 80. And that seemed like a really huge number to me. And then I kept going, and here I am at 86, right? Yeah. I'll be 87 in November.
All right. Let's talk a little more about this role, because it was an amazing play. In fact, the New York Times quote said, "Now 86, Miss Parsons has lost little, if any, of her energy, absolutely none of her ability to bring sustained, animated life to a well-drawn character. She never leaves the stage during this 90-minute two-character play." It just goes on and on and on. In the play, you are playing a strong willed 79-year-old artist who not only refuses to move out of her home into an assisted living facility, something many of our listeners can relate to, you actually threaten to blow up the entire building if they try to force you to move out. That sounds like a meaty role. Did you enjoy doing it?
Oh, yeah, it was an amazing experience, a huge, huge challenge, because this woman has had, unlike myself, this woman has had a couple of dementia moments. So inside, she's a little rattled. But, you know, I was just thinking this morning, because my kids are here visiting, because I've got to go to the Tonys this week, and my husband's got a big award as well, which is kind of nice. But anyway, you know, the terrible thing is you let other people do for you. And you just can't let that happen. You've got to keep doing for yourself. So I think, really, people shouldn't be allowed to go to assisted living homes unless they want to. And that's the difference. People who want to go love it there. People who are forced to go never like it there. That's the difference. But you have got to keep doing for yourself. Someone says, take my seat on the subway. You say, no, thanks, I'd rather stand up. You've got to keep moving your body around. That's the key to keeping going for long, 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 is to keep moving. But that's what life is all about. All kinds of life is constantly moving, right? We can't stand still. I've talked so much, I'm exhausted.
You know what? We could listen to you for just about ever. And listening to you, it does seem as though this role was actually made for you, because at one point in the play, your character, really in a sense of despair, says, what the world is taking away from me, what time is taking away from me, what God is taking away from me is me. And
yeah.
you seem to have such a strong sense of me, Estelle.
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky I'm healthy, you know. Jewish people are always talking about how important health is, and I realize they are right. Because if you don't have your health, you know, it's pretty hard to keep the other stuff going if you don't have good health. And I'm very fortunate that I do. I'm Swedish stock and old New England stock, and, you know, it's certainly serving me well.
Broadway's a brutal schedule on 30-year-olds, Estelle. You know, I don't want to beat this into the ground.
It's a tough schedule. Yeah, you've got to get geared up for work, you know, but it's like living on another plane. You get geared up, and then you do it. You're like a horse who runs races, you know. That's what you do, and so your whole being is geared up. And you don't realize how geared up you got until a show closes, and then you kind of see yourself, you know, gearing down to be an ordinary human being again. It's a very interesting process.
So
and
what,
a tough one. Everybody isn't built for that kind of, you know, up and down, up and down, up and down.
So what do you
do? If you are built for it and you love it, you know, that's what you do.
What do you do now, Estelle, in the middle? Where do you look for your next project?
Well, I've got another lot of projects going, of course. Other theater projects, and I've got a movie, kind of a Bonnie and Clyde for the older set going, so we're trying to get that financed and get that started. And, you know, things like that. I got a lot of stuff going, and I'm always busy at the Actors Studio, where I'm directing a couple of pieces that are going out on various kinds of tours and stuff. So I never stop being busy. That's the beauty of being a member of the Actors Studio. You're just working for nothing instead of money, which is a big difference. But nonetheless, you're busy, busy, busy. So that's good.
Not only are you a member of the Actors Studio, you've been inducted into the Theater Hall of Fame.
And they're honoring me. In a couple of weeks, we have this big luncheon where they're honoring me and giving money to grants, you know, to young people who are just starting out. Which is when you really need money, when you really care about money.
Well,
yeah.
You are a delight and a pleasure, and we love your energy so much, Estelle. We know that the best is still ahead for you. Folks, she's an Academy Award-winning actress, a Tony Award-winning performer on the stage. Estelle Parsons is her name, and we will watch very closely, anxiously awaiting to see what is next. Estelle, thank you so much for your time.
Have you got the travel bug? Well, coming up next, one of America's top travel experts joins us to tell us how to be the world's smartest traveler. Next on Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
This is Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton, and that, of course, is Bill Schaefer. And our next guest is a consumer advocate who specializes in travel. He's a pioneer in digital journalism. In fact, he founded the Internet's first business travel website back in 1994, and he began blogging in 1996 before it was even called blogging.
Pretty much a visionary, huh? He became ABCNews.com's first travel columnist in 97, hosted a cable TV show, and the guys worked with NPR, ABC, NBC, CNN, and the BBC. He's a nationally syndicated columnist for National Geographic, USA Today, Huntington Post. You kind of get the idea, folks. This guy gets around. And he's got a new book out called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. Let's find out more from Chris Elliott. How are you, Chris?
Hey, I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Are you someplace exotic and exciting, or where are you today?
I am in Cedar City, Utah, which is both exotic and exciting. This is an area that is known for its national parks and its famous Utah Shakespeare Festival, too, here at Southern Utah University.
Not bad. Pretty interesting. Hey, you know, you live the kind of life that most of us dream about. Your family is pretty much on an open-ended journey around the world as you cover adventure for all those different organizations we talked about. Do you ever get tired of it?
That's a great question. Every now and then I do get a little fatigued, but when I take a week off, and I'm always reminded of the fact that traveling is a privilege, and so I try not to take anything for granted.
So is your next book then going to be called like Staying at Home with Chris?
I love to travel, actually, and but there is a time to sort of take time off and not do that. I'm not sure if I'm going to call my sequel Staying at Home. I don't know how well that would sell.
You know, you've always been an advocate for consumers, Chris. In general, I think most of us are displeased with the customer service of airlines. How would you rate the industry as a whole today from that perspective?
I would like to hope that things have gotten better, but based on my own experience, and you're right, in addition to traveling a lot, I deal with people's travel problems. I write a syndicated column that appears in a lot of newspapers across the country, and my experience is that airline service in general is not getting better. What airlines have done over the last couple of years is something called unbundling, where they've taken things that are traditionally included in the price of your seat, such as the ability to make a seat reservation, a meal, a checked bag, and they've taken that out. And that's generated a lot of complaints. It's made the overall cost of air travel higher. And at the same time, in order to make more money, they've reduced services. So now if you want to make a reservation by phone, they're going to add a surcharge to that. Oftentimes the service levels you get on flights are bad. They were bad before. They don't seem to be getting any better, unfortunately. So that keeps me very busy as a consumer advocate.
You know, Chris, you ask them and they go, well, yeah, we do that to try to save you money if you don't want this stuff. But I guess that's not happening. Are there any airlines out there you like that are doing it right?
I do, yes. I like Southwest Airlines and JetBlue. I like Virgin America. I like some of the international carriers like Cathay Pacific and Singapore. They seem to have a really great service culture and they seem to do things right. And they have happy employees, too, and I think that counts for something.
And your new book, Chris, is titled How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. Give us a couple of tips. What can we do to get closer to that?
Well, smart travel means being prepared, first and foremost. Most of the problems that I deal with in my book are problems that can be easily avoided if you just do a little advanced planning. So my first suggestion would be to do some of the common sense things that people just seem to avoid or take for granted when they're on the road. For example, a lot of people don't call their airline to confirm that their flight is leaving on time or even bother to check their smartphones before they go somewhere. And they show up at the airport and their flight is delayed or canceled. The same thing for a hotel. Call to make sure that you still have a reservation. Have a packing list, for instance. Those are all things that you don't really need a book to be able to do. my book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler, actually focuses on the other 10% of problems that aren't so easy to see on the horizon. And there are actually some really great tips that I offer for how to overcome some of these I would say, things that you just can't necessarily see coming your way and plan for.
And I'm kind of intrigued now, Chris. What kind of things are you talking about?
Well, you know, one of the things I deal with in almost every chapter is how to avoid a problem when it becomes a problem. So, for example, if you have a service problem, if you do show up at your hotel and it doesn't have a reservation, what are the ways of ensuring that you do get a hotel room for that night? And one of the things that I advise in the book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler, is to resolve any problem that you possibly can in real time. If you don't do that, and if you wait to get home, then you're probably going to have very limited success in having the travel company resolve it. A lot of times, employees have the ability to fix things right then and there that they wouldn't if you've come home and you've decided to write an angry letter to the travel company.
We're talking to Chris Elliott, who's written a new book called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. Chris, it seems like no matter what we buy these days, in every store we go into, they want to sell us insurance. Is travel insurance a good idea in general?
Yeah, actually, the first chapter of this book that I wrote was on travel insurance. And, yeah, it absolutely is something you should consider. The rule of thumb is if you have a trip that you've spent about $5,000 on or more, then you'll definitely want to consider insurance. However, if you've spent less, and maybe if you don't want to lose the value of your trip, it's something that you should think about. There are really two kinds of travel insurance. There's the garden variety with named perils, which means that there are some restrictions that apply. And then there's a cancel for any reason insurance policy that you can get. And that allows you to cancel, as the policy says, for any reason and get a percentage of your purchase back.
That's a great advice there. Is this a good time to go in our last 30 seconds? You know, coming out of the recession, are there deals to find if we're just sharp about it?
Oh, absolutely. If you go on a trip when no one else is going, so if you're planning on going to the beach, maybe pick an off-season time.
Like in the winter.
Deal. And you know, just cast a very wide net, too. There's so many deals to be found online. And don't forget about travel agents, because they sometimes have deals that you're not going to be able to find even online.
Good stuff, Chris. Our thanks to you. The book is called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. It's available on Amazon and other online book retailers as well. And you can also learn more by checking out his website. Do it before you go. It's Elliott.org. Thanks again, Chris.
We've heard from some pretty impressive people on this program, so now it's time to take a minute to think about you. What's your Growing Bolder story? What do you want it to be? Think about it, craft it, and then find a way to start living it.
Stop trying to define people by their age alone. It's a whole new world out there where it's not about age, it's about attitude, and that's Growing Bolder.
The Growing Bolder radio show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty trapped. Countless fire and flaming road, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I. Proud, neat, heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older then.
older then, I'm younger than that now. In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs to teach. Fearing not, I'd become my enemy in the instant that I preach. Systems fled by confusion boats, mutiny from stern to bow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. So much older than, I'm younger than that.